name's Helen Tubby. I'm editor of Family Tree, and we're here today with another episode of Family Tree Talk. And with me is
Nathan Ward. Hello there.
Okay, so we have got a lot to talk about today, haven't we?
I guess we do, maybe. Depends if I've done my homework properly or not, but...
Yes, so have you done your homework?
Yes, so I was putting in all of my great-grandparents' wedding details, and I've done all but one because it was a question mark and there was only a year on there. There was nothing concrete. So you told me to go to the GRO website and get their certificate. And so I went and did that. I can't remember the name of the first one you go to where you type in the names and it gives you a reference. What was that one called again?
Pre-BMD, probably.
So I went to do that. I typed in both grandparents' names and it gave me two references as to where it would be. So then I could use that on the GRO website. This is taking some remembering. And when I went there, It started telling me that it would be £15 to get the wedding certificate. So being a little bit tight like I am, I thought, oh, is there a different way I can do this? And I have noticed a few bits and bats on Ancestry already. It wasn't a wedding certificate. I can't remember quite what it was, but there was hints about the marriage.
Well, do you know what? From the sound of it, I think you've done a really good bit of detective work and you've done a really good bit of detective work despite me giving you some daft information in last week's podcast. Okay, so I have to confess to you, Nathan, that I was a bit like fudgy. I don't know what was happening, whether I was just like half asleep, brewing a cold, who knows what. But anyway, I gave you some dodgy information, which wasn't quite right. So as I'm a nitpicker, I have to set the record straight. So last week I said, you go to the GRO websites and you can order a certificate and you can order a certificate for a marriage. That's completely fine. And it should be about £12.50. Yeah. But and if you were going to order a birth or a death, depending on which years, the further back you go, the more recent decades you can't. But the further back you go, you should be able to order either a birth certificate, death certificate. You could also order them as PDFs or JPEGs and they'll be like £8 or £3. So they'll be less money and you'll get the JPEG for the birth or death more quickly. But for marriage, this isn't available. So this is important because it means your only option on the GRO website is that £12.50 fee. And obviously you didn't want to pay for that, even though you get really, really good information. So you thought, how else can I get the evidence I need about my great-grandparents' marriage, and you went off to Ancestry to see what you could find. So you did a really, really, like, that's good, realistic thinking. And so can you remember a little bit more about what you actually found?
Yeah, well, I've not paid for the subscription yet, but in the hints, it does obviously, it shows you a bunch of documents that you can look at. And even though I've not paid for it, when you click in, does it scan the text, I'm guessing, of the document? Because it gives you relevant information. So the one that I found was the Civil Register of Marriage Index, 1916 to 2005.
Mm.
And on that, it's got My Tree. And on the app, it says My Tree, and it's got Phyllis McKay. It's got the marriage date, which I've got question marks on.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's matched it with the information on this registration thing, certificate, or index, should I say. And it's got a date on it.
Mm.
I
think what Ancestry are providing you with, by the sound of it, though, because that index, that civil registration index, then that only has basic information on it. So that's the same as what the free BMD index would have and the GRO index. And if it's a civil registration index on Ancestry, then again, it would just have basic information. It will tell you the rough quarter. So you'll know if your ancestor was married in a quarter of the year, so the first quarter, the March quarter, second quarter, June quarter, etc., through the year.
Right.
So if you found more information than that, I think you're looking at some sort of church registers. And so the church registers, it could be a nonconformist church or it could be a parish church for this period, so that early 20th century, that marriage register is going to have the same information as the £12.50 marriage certificate. So if you can find this marriage register entry on Ancestry and you can get clues from that, then you're going to save yourself your £12.50. So by the sound of it, even though you haven't paid, because you haven't paid, you're not able to see a really clear image of the register. But what you can do is you can get really cool clues. I mean, as you say, you've got a precise date of marriage. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I did an update to this app today.
Yeah.
And the picture that it's showing me now doesn't have as much information. So it's like they've got savvy. So previously, I'm going to have to find this. At the moment, it's telling me that on this record, the marriage date is in October 1924. And if I look at the original image, because I took a screen grab of it, so I wouldn't lose it. I'm actually confusing myself. I was looking at a different register, but this is interesting because what you've just said about the quarter, on this new information that I'm looking at, this index, it says October 1924. And the thing I've saved is actually the nonconformist record. And that has the marriage date of 20th of December, 1924. So there's a big discrepancy that I was a bit worried about, but obviously you've just explained that to me. So one's based on the quarter and doesn't have as much information.
I was going to say, so with any index, an index is only cut down information, isn't it? Like imagine the index at the end of a book. You don't want it to have everything in there because it's like you read the book. So the index has brief overview information. So rather than telling you the precise date, it just tells you the quarter because it's just a kind of precis of the information.
Sure. That just makes it more confusing though, doesn't it? Obviously, because it's chosen to give me a month, saying October 1924, I could have gone away and put that down, but according to this non-conformist record, it's the 20th of December. So Would you say that record's right then? Or am I going to actually have to go in and buy it to confirm?
So I think if you have a precise date, on the whole, precise information, you should definitely prick up your ears with precise information because that's much more likely. It is more precise, whether it's more accurate, but it's more precise, isn't it? Whether it's more accurate is another question. So I would make a note of that 20th of December 1924. You can even add it to your tree, and what you're going to say is your source, so how you know that information is where you got it from, is you got it from the search results on Ancestry for the nonconformist record collection for West Yorkshire. So that's your source, and so you know that and you can say it's just the search results, and you could even write a note to yourself saying I haven't seen the original document. And then once you start paying for Ancestry, subscribing, then the image will be clear to you. You're able to view the image. And so the index, even if it's given you a precise date, it's probably not given you, or it definitely won't have given you all the information you can get if you pay. So the index has probably given you the person who you've searched for's name. You might have some other place location information. So that's going to tell you whether you're warm or cold. Like, does the place information, does that seem plausible for your great granny? Would you expect to find her roughly living in that sort of part of the world?
I guess so. I did question this quickly with my mum, and she started getting a bit funny about it, saying they wouldn't be in that area. It's a bit too far away. Which obviously now knowing my family and my DNA history, that's probably true because it's not Pudsey. But the rest of it matches up. So I guess until I dive in, I'm going to have to dive in, aren't I? And see who's related. I mean, I can actually make out the name Vernon Wood on this screen grab. So it definitely is the right person. So there's extra information that maybe my mum doesn't know about.
Mm.
So I'm going to have to take the dip out and subscribe for a bit.
Mm.
But that's quite cool because, like, once I've done this, I feel I want to try and get the parents of my great-great-grandparents. And I feel like that's probably a good point for me to jump on.
Really, really good. So this marriage register entry is very likely to include both the names of the father of your great-granny and her husband, should say your great-grandpa, hopefully your great-grandpa.
Right, so cool.
So it's going to include the fathers of the bride and groom. And so that gives you one more generation, doesn't it? It's giving you two great-great-grandfathers. It also includes some information about home addresses. Sometimes, it's definitely worth noting the addresses. Sometimes they're only temporary addresses, but it's worth noting the addresses. It will give information potentially about their occupations their ages. So these are all clues. If you don't know your great granny's birth, then that's really helpful, isn't it? Because if you've got an age on her marriage certificate, that can give you a ballpark date to start looking for her birth. Same for your great grandpa, her husband. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's brilliant. And that's, again, I keep going on about it, but like, for me, that's the exciting bit to start, because I haven't done any official hands-on research apart from what I've just done.
Yes.
So finding these dates is going to be exciting.
It will be exciting, because that's what you need to do when you get any record. Don't just think, oh, it's my great-granny's marriage certificate. I now know about her marriage. That's not a bit of it. You're finding out about the places, other people. It's building out other generations, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
and giving you occupational clues. Occupational clues are so helpful, because if you've got several people with the same name, if you know what occupation your ancestor had, obviously people do change their lines of work, but it can help you think, this is the right guy. He's a joiner. He was a joiner there. He's a joiner there. Out of the three Fred Smiths, the only one here is a joiner. I think I'm onto something. And it makes you know whether your leads are warmer or colder.
Putting all the puzzle together, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I like what you were saying as well about like making a note of the source where it came from, because that's throwing me back to that research log, so that when I forget what I've done in a few weeks' time, or probably tomorrow, I can go back to that research log and be like, oh yeah, this was came from here, and that's how I got it, and that's how I know that.
It's such a good idea. Otherwise, you can't, because what you're doing, and Ancestry are really helpful. I don't know whether you've found it on the app yet, or I don't know whether it's not available on the app, but definitely on the website. You can note how confident you are about, you know, the information you're adding. So look out for those little tags, and then you can flag it up to yourself whether you're super confident or whether you're not confident yet. In your research log, you can say, you know, what you found, where you found it. Even include a link, just copy and paste the link, because then you can hop straight back to that place, you know, that you found on Ancestry or wherever else you found the information, your GRO links from the Gender Register Office. Copy all these links in, because they just save you legwork revisiting things. Because in a few months' time, you may decide, you are going to want to revisit things, and you'll be able to not be left wondering. And when you're saying, like, why you kind of ascertain something, or why the jigsaw puzzles seem to be adding up to something, writing down why you think something, that's something I've been really bad at over the years. And every time I have done it, I've been like, yes, it's so useful. And it's such an important bit of doing your family history in a thorough and provable way that you can say to other people in the months and years to come, this is why I've deduced this or that.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Because otherwise it feels like it would be a backward step, because you're kind of having to go and retrace it all again from scratch. It's like, how did I get here again? And it's like relearning the process, isn't it? Whereas like, if it's written down, it's there, you know where to look. This is why I found it. Boom. That just relaxes me a bit, because obviously with so many things, there's so many like processes and bits and bats to remember. Like I'm obviously thinking about my job right now. Once you've got it down, it's good, isn't it? You can forget about it and know it's fact.
And it's really a good idea to even, lots of us do family history, like we're snatching family history time and then we have to rush off and do something else. But even if you can just weave in 30 seconds or a few minutes at the end of a session to quickly summarize, this is, you know, what I found and why I think it, so then you can kind of consolidate that and have it written down in some sort of format, really serve you well.
Yeah, definitely. Save on time and energy.
And there's a kind of, it's a twofold thing as well. So partly when I'm saying write down the information, there's so many ways to kind of keep thinking about family history. So when you write down the information, you're writing it down for you. But when I keep saying write down what you've discovered, you are writing it down for you. And when I say, yes, it is worth paying for things because you're going to find extra clues, it is worth paying for things because you're going to find those extra clues. So part of your writing down, you can write down, you know, this is what I've discovered so far, you're going to know that you aren't subscribing to Ancestry, and that's where you can add a note into your research log of things that you want to go back and revisit once you are paying. So you can write like hashtag to do get this record, include the link of the search result you've got, and you know once you've got a paid membership to Ancestry, you can revisit that link, you'll be able to see the document correctly, get all those full luscious details that you don't have yet, and add them all to your tree. Yeah?
Yeah.
You're using your research log to help you, because it could be that you say, well, I don't really want to subscribe to Ancestry right now, but I will take a 14-day free trial. And when I do, I'm going to make the most of those 14 days. And you've got a great big shopping list of things you can look at. And obviously, Ancestry wouldn't thank any of us if that's what we did all the time. But if somebody's new to family history and you're feeling your way and you're not sure whether you want to commit yourself to actually becoming a bona fide long-term family historian, I think that's where it has a 14-day free trial. And you can see, is this something I really want to get into and invest my money in and time and everything doing going forward? So I think that's not a bad plan. And you can't keep doing it. You can only do your 14-day free trial once. And so I think it's okay. So
yeah,
I think that's perfectly reasonable.
But you want to get the most out of that time, don't you? So yeah. It's knowing what's in there and what value it has for you. And
yes, and you'll be able to kind of put not just Ancestry, but any company that you're using. If you've got a hit list of things you want to try and learn about or discover or find, then you're going to be able to better explore the search, you know, the search system, better explore the databases, and you know, find out whether they're on your. It's like when you could take a car for a test drive. Some dashboards you hate on a car. I just don't want this car. It's a horrible dashboard, and you don't even want to go any further. And then other cars you just like from the get go, and. The people who designed it are on your wavelength and you want to use that company. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So what can I get then with my Ancestry time? Like if I'm at a stage now, obviously I'm trying to finish that marriage thing. So I will definitely, that'll be my first part of call is checking that document that it's presented me. You've just said that I can get to my great, great, great.
Two greats.
Yeah.
So your great granny's dad and your great grandpa's dad will be on that marriage record,
right? And that's going to be easy enough for me to find. I mean, I think I've got some details in my mum's documents. What can I get from Ancestry that's going to help me progress that further?
Okay, so what is really helpful, and lots of people do this, is you can either draw it up in a spreadsheet, or you could try Googling for a family record sheet. That could be a good kind of search term to look for. But if you imagine you get a spreadsheet, and you can do this for each of your ancestors, you can even do it for your mum, dad, all four of your grandparents, all eight of your great-grandparents, all 16 of your great-great-grandparents, literally give them a line each on an Excel sheet. And then going across the columns, you're going to write, for each column is going to be a methodical fact column for something you need. So you need a birth for each of them, or it could be a baptism entry or birth. The next column, you're going to want their marriage. The next column, you're going to want their death, and you also have their burial. And then the other thing, which is really useful, is the census record. So working, because you're always thinking of working backwards in time with family history, because you're working from facts you know, people you know, or more recent to you, maybe you could ask your mum about it or whatever, and then you're working backs in time, so you're thinking of the 1939 register, which is available online for England and Wales on Ancestry, and also on Find My Past as well. It's like it's available in a few different locations, and then you're getting back into the census proper, so the 1921 census, 1911, 1901 goes for every 10 years to 1841. So again, these things I've said, those birth or baptism, marriage, death or burial, 1939 register, 1921 census, back every 10 years to 1841. Those are your hit list for, you want those details for each of your ancestors. Obviously, not all of your ancestors are going to appear in all of the censuses. It depends how long someone's alive for, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you, once you've got their birth and death dates, you can mark that on your spreadsheet and you know, okay, they were born in 1872, they died in 1942, the records I've got to go at are the 1881 census, 91, so forth. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And you can put X's in the things that they're not alive for, so you don't waste time looking for them. But it's quite an easy way. I don't know whether you're a fan of spreadsheets, Excel and stuff like that.
It's slowly growing on me. Like again, I said, like the research log, I never thought I'd be that sort of guy, but I see the benefit of it. And there's so much information in this to juggle with. A spreadsheet just seemed like the sensible thing to do. It's just been willing to be that meticulous, isn't it? And the way you talk to me makes me want to use them. So
I love it. I couldn't do a single sum on Excel. I literally just use it for making really beautiful color-coded lists of what I need to accomplish.
Hopefully.
Yes.
It works.
Yeah. Yeah, it works for me. So that's the endless thing, isn't it? as long as it works for you, it's good.
I am very excited to look at some of these proper records, though. Like, because I haven't hit or touched. I know I'm not going to touch because they're digital, but I've not looked at a proper document that makes me feel like this is history. So I am quite excited to take the subscription and have a look at some of these documents and read the handwriting, because it's all handwritten. Looks cool. It's exciting, that bit.
It is so cool. And so you're going to find out about occupations that your ancestor had. And so straight away, that takes you into a different world, because the occupations we do and how we do them, many of us, they just weren't even invented, lots of us, even 5 years ago. So you're going to just have different terminology, and that's going to make you feel you're in a different historic world, because you are. And when you look at, I banged on a minute ago about the marriage records, don't just think you're getting marriage details off a marriage certificate, you're getting all sorts of other family information. And the same with the census. It's not just let's say you're looking up your great-great-grandpa in the census. Obviously, you're going to find him probably living with other family members. So you're going to find further relations. So yeah. Don't just do like smash and grab, get the details for your great-great-grandpa and add them to the tree. Make sure you save down or take a screen grab or whatever of that copy of the census. Add the details for all of those people to your family tree, because that's the start of your quest. This will help you with your DNA research. The more people you have on your tree, the better able your matches will be able to see how you relate to them. Your DNA will become more fun and friendly, because they won't just be an anonymous list of, or not anonymous because you've got their names, but, you know, unidentified list of people.
Yeah, this list really does excite me. It's silly. I want to see, like, the lines connecting and all the dots matching and everything. It just really does appeal. I guess it's that sleuthing, isn't it? It's just, I'm clearly like romanticizing it and a bit lost in it, but it's what I want to do, go on in a bit of a history lesson. I don't know.
No, I think that's a good idea. And I think lots of us do romanticize it. Yeah, we often talk about our family story, and I think that's a luxury. We can pick and choose what we find in the records and which ones, which people intrigue us and who we want to learn out more about, whether it's somebody's occupation, whether you're finding, maybe you find your great-great-grandfather and he's not living with his family, and that begs all sorts of other questions, like, has he got a challenging job that's taken him away from home? Has the family broken down? These are all really relatable things, which sometimes it's quite comforting to realise that life keeps on going round, and although history is really different in lots of ways, lots of our ancestors have, experiences that we can recognise.
Yeah, definitely. This is slightly tangential, but I was daydreaming the other day about my family tree, and I was thinking about, like, there's going to be a point where I want to add, the brothers and the sisters, and then, it makes my mind explode thinking about doing that part. But then I remembered that I had an Auntie Mildred when I was a child. And I know she's a blood relation of some sort. It wasn't like, oh, your nana's friends, cousins, brothers, sister. It wasn't somebody that we called auntie. She was my Auntie Mildred. And I, honest to God, until this week, hadn't really realised, I don't know who she is. I don't know how she fits into my family. And I think my mum could probably answer this one if I just asked her. But I'm kind of intrigued not to do it that way and just find out where she is. Because I remember like 80th and 90th birthday parties, and everybody came around, and it was clearly on my mum's mum's side, but I don't know who she was.
Brilliant.
I don't know whose sister she was or whose mother she was or anything. And I think she might have been my great great aunt. I'm not entirely sure, but it was just one of those ones where, like, it sounds awful, but I'd forgotten about her. Like, as a child, we'd go over and look after and help out, etc. But it was just always a given, like, oh yeah, you have to see Auntie Mildred. And until now, I hadn't actually placed her in time with anyone or connected her to my tree. I think there's a vague story about her husband helping design some part on the Concorde. But again, that could be wrong. I could have made that up. It's this vague remembered childhood thing. So I've got some little things to investigate there that I'm quite intrigued by.
You have. I love it. I love the fact you're daydreaming about your family tree. That's just such a lovely idea. And I think probably lots of us have these aunties and uncles, and particularly people, if they don't have any descendants, I think we owe it to just the fact of remembering people to include them it's really important to include the side branches in our own, in each of our family histories to keep everybody passed down. Otherwise, it's a kind of skinny little line of, you know, a pedigree. And that's not how our ancestors experienced their lives. Our ancestors' siblings and, you know, aunts and uncles and cousins and things, that's all the context that they grow up in and live in. And as you say, people you visit, the people who you care about. So it's really important that we remember them. So it's really good you've got her. So hey, write her on your research log that you need to find out about her, because otherwise you'll get immersed in your Victorians and then it'll be 2 years' time and you'll go, I never did find out who Auntie Mildred was.
Yeah, definitely. I am intrigued. It's so funny though. It's just such a weird thing to think you never, I guess children don't think about these things, but I just never placed her within the tree ever. It was just like, yeah, she's my auntie. But I do, again, I think vaguely, I've mentioned it before, there's a war story about somebody dying in a tank.
Mm.
I think that's a relative of hers. And again, I've only got these little fragments of my childhood memory about her and what and where these stories have come from. Like the Concord thing could be completely wrong. But I do think that the tank part is her. And that's an interesting story because, like, as we discussed previously, we're watching SAS Rogue Heroes. I kind of want to get into the war story part of it and find out who went to war and where they went. Because that, again, is really interesting and intriguing.
I think I could feel another list coming on, Nathan, because you have got quite a lot of questions going on there. And then you say, sometimes it's the sheer number of people or the sheer amount of information you want to find out. And sometimes it makes your head swim and it's just going round and round. And it can feel a bit overwhelming. And it's, you just don't want to forget any of these things once you've got curious about them. But sometimes they can just get crowded out because new thoughts and new ideas come along. So I think you need to add another, whether another sheet on your Excel file or whether you write it on a bit of paper or whatever and write down, you know, who was Auntie Mildred? Did her husband work for or design a bit of Concord? Was Auntie Mildred's... who was Auntie Mildred's contact, the man who died in the tank in World War II? Just write it down, super scruffy and vague, and you can head it up. These are childhood memories or family anecdotes or things dredged off in your memory. Call it whatever you want so you know where these crazy questions are coming from. And then if ever there's a rainy afternoon and you're wondering what to do, you can dive into one of these questions and make a start.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, I am literally just writing this down.
No time like the present. Write it down now. Yeah.
It's on my research log to-do list now.
Excellent. Excellent. I love it. You know, I had a similar situation. I have somebody who's called Uncle Alan, and I love my Uncle Alan. He died when I was about 11, and I went to a boarding school, so I used to write letters to Uncle Alan, and he used to write letters back to me. And I was really sad because the last letter I wrote to him, he never got because he died before. And you know, when you're a child, like some things are disproportionately sad. And I was like, he didn't get my letter. And I felt really sad about it. But he turned out, my Uncle Alan, when I started doing my family history, I was like, oh, he's actually my granny's uncle. And so, but his name never got kind of recalibrated for each generation. He was just always called Uncle Alan. Yeah. He was a lovely old guy. And then when I was digitizing the family photo albums, which my Uncle Alex lent to me, I found this wonderful picture. And Uncle Alan, I only knew him as a really old boy living in a little bungalow, and he smoked like mad. The whole of his inside of his house was mustard yellow. But there were these pictures of him wearing a kilt in the First World War, and he's a really tall, he was a really good looking tall young man. And it was just seeing a whole different side of him, you know, just decades and decades before. Yeah, it's just funny. Yeah.
It's just terrifyingly big, isn't it, as well? Like, I've mentioned to my mum what I'm doing, and she's like, why are you following the Phyllis McKay line? I haven't shown any interest in that. I've done nothing on that. And I'm like, I don't know. It's just got my attention. And it's like, again, why you have the research log, I guess, because you can just, there's so many different ways you can go or choose to get lost. I don't know. It's baffling.
I think you've got a good program at the moment, haven't you? Good set of steps you're trying to do. You're getting those great grandparents' marriages. You're going to be building on the next generation, and you're going to be building out. So for your great grandparents and your great great grandparents, once you've got those key details, birth, marriage, and deaths, I think you need to be looking out for their siblings. So using things like the 1939 register, those censuses I talked about,
okay,
what era you're in. I think you will be in the right era to be using those records. The censuses will help you find their siblings as you work back in time. and your tree will suddenly just blossom out, because you're not just talking a doubling of direct ancestors, you just go back each generation. They're going to have several kids.
Yeah. And is there a natural point for me to be doing that? Is it, because like in my head, I'm like, I'll just keep going back on the direct route until I get stuck, and then I'll go and flesh everybody else out further with the siblings. Or I guess I learn this whilst I'm looking at records. It's better to do it when you're looking at the record, because like you've said, it mentions four or five people's names that I might not have.
I would be inclined to not try and hurtle back, just grabbing the core details and then having the next generation. And the reason is because the more information you can get about any one person, then the more confident you can be when you work back in time. Yes, I have got the right people. Because by looking at your ancestors' siblings, finding out, noting down the addresses, noting down occupations that anybody has, then when you are finding people, you know, in the previous generation, or, you know, working back through the censuses, you'll have a flavour. You'll go, this is really inconsistent. This person is, you know, completely the wrong place, or they've got the wrong set of children's names, or did they really have such a massive career improvement in a decade? Maybe some people do and some people don't. But you've just got more information that you can cross-check with each other to make you feel confident whether you're on the right track. And there's another side to this as well. As you're searching, you'll get a flavour. Some people have unusual names and they're quite lucky, you know, lucky breaks for you, because you're not going to get in a muddle with lots of different other search results.
Mm.
Other people are going to have really common names. And that's such a useful thing to know, that your ancestor has a really common name, even if you might think it was quite an unusual name. In one particular locality, in one little town, that name could be really, really popular. That's, you know, perfectly happens all the time. So you need to know if there are other possible contenders for your ancestor. So you don't think, they've got an unusual name, there they are, I found them. Whereas if you know, in my town, this name is common as muck, I need to be vigilant. I really have got the right person by that name. So by being thorough and slow it down at each stage, you will reap so many rewards. You'll be more knowledgeable about your family, which is fun in itself. And it's informative to your massive database of information that you're gathering in your head and in your research log and on your family tree. Yeah, take it slow. Take it slow and build up thoroughly. That's what I would say.
Yeah. It's hard, isn't it? I want to do it at an enjoyable pace where it feels like fun. But you always do seem to, well, I do. I always seem to have one mind on the future and the potential expansions and this way and that way. And then clearly I keep on going off on little tangents. Keeping it sort of streamlined and focused is really hard. I really like the research log now, because it's, even if it's not necessarily me making progress backwards, it's at least a focus for like this week. I can just look at this and think about that, as opposed to being like, oh my God, it's everywhere. It's everything. I can't do anything. Rabbit in the headlights sort of scenario.
I think you're going to like having the Excel sheet with each of your, you know, I said about all the columns for like birth, marriage, death, census. I think you'll find them helpful as well, because that will calm you down, because you'll be able to look at that and you'll be able to see at a glance what you found for each of your ancestors. And it'll also give you a really helpful launch pad. When you sit down to do some research, you'll go, okay, I haven't got any of the census or the 1939 register for my great granny. I'm going to look for it for her and see what I can find. And you, yeah, in your research log, what you found and didn't find.
That sounds good. Because, like I've said before, I love the Ancestry app, but sometimes it's hard to actually get into the details to know which bit you're missing. Like for me saying, oh, I'm missing a bit of information. When I was looking for the one set of great-grandparents that I didn't have the marriage date for, I wasn't sure which one it was instantly. So I was clicking into each single one individually. But what you're saying is, yeah, get it on a list and it's just at hand straight away, isn't it? It's good. Oh, God, you're making me really officious. I'm not sure I like it.
And another thing, like when a new record collection comes out, so this is really exciting. So the 1921 census has only very recently become available on Ancestry. It's been available on Find My Past for the last 3 years, since 2022. So when a new record collection comes out, then it can be really helpful. You you can either do it methodically or you can just sit down and drum up in your head, write a list of all the possible people who are alive during that time period. And then, you know, like a hit list of who you're going to go and try and find in the new record collection.
Right.
So but you've got to be methodical. Like you can just dive in idly and have a glass of wine and muddle around, and that's fun. There's no harm in that. But over time, you will find it more rewarding and get better results if you think lists.
Yeah, definitely. I guess I agree. It is nice to cross stuff off as well. It's if you've got them on your list and you can take them off. It's a sense of progress, isn't it? It's always good. It gives you that hit.
And when you get stuck as well, that's when it really comes into its own if you are methodical. Because let's say you got stuck and you can't find somebody, then sometimes, let's say you can't find somebody in one census, you might think, right, I'm going to leave that census and I'm going to go to the previous census. And if you know information about them, so you know their siblings or their spouse or their parents, you know, if you've got other clues about them, then you can more confidently leapfrog a record collection that you can't find them in and find them in, preceding a kind of a slightly tangential record. You're not always going to be able to go from one record to the other, because sometimes the pages of your ancestor have got lost, or the handwriting's been written terribly and can't be interpreted by the person who's putting the database together. So there's all sorts of reasons why you might not be able to find somebody. But if you are methodical and you've got your list and you've checked where you've looked, you've checked, written down where you've looked, and you've got a note of what you found, then it's easier for you to troubleshoot yourself. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas if you've just got a swimmy mess, just be basically swimming around, like, I know what it'd be like. You're on a dinghy and you're on a lovely lake and it's dark and you put a blindfold on, and then the wind's blown. You have no idea which direction your dinghy's going, and it's going round and round and round in circles, and you just keep going round and round, occasionally bumping into something. Whereas if you have your methodical plan, you've got a torch, you've got a compass, you've got a research log of what you've done and where you're going, all of it.
Yeah, yeah. For me, the not starting again element of it is really key. Once something's known and it's written down, I think that's brilliant. I like that a lot. Nice one.
So do we have any other questions this week, Nathan?
Right, yes, we do have a question, Helen. Here it comes. Dear Helen, I was hoping you might be able to give me some advice or point me to someone who can. Unfortunately, my father passed away last year. He had been working on our family tree for many years and has progressed from visiting church and library records in the early days to using various software and websites, and more recently using DNA to help with his research. We are aware of multiple subscriptions which he held, and these are starting to need to be renewed at some cost. We really don't know where to start in terms of ensuring we don't lose all of his work, but clearly cannot continue with all the subscriptions forever. I have found many issues of your magazine in his effects and wonder if you might be able to advise on what people should do to preserve someone's genealogy research when they have passed on. Some of the sites he has subscribed to are MyHeritage, Ancestry, GEDmatch Tier 21, and Find My Past. He also has Roots Magic on his Apple Mac. Any advice or suggestions will be welcome. From Tim.
Wow. So this is potentially a question that you can relate to. So Tim's in the point of view that his dear dad has passed away and handed down, or he's been left with, the family history subscriptions and a whole bunch of family history information, and he doesn't know what to do with it. And in a little way, like, you've got all that information from your mum, and it can feel quite overwhelming to be kind of, even though your mum is happily still with us, to have a big bunch of information but not have a kind of any welcome letter to it. It can be a bit overwhelming, can't it?
Yeah, definitely. It can be forgotten as well quite easily, like I could just ignore it.
So for Tim, he's in at the deep end. So his dad's done lots of family history and he doesn't know what to do. At least you're in a better position than him because you're interested. So I guess what he needs to do, his dad spent lots of time and effort presumably putting together the family history, and so Tim needs to make sure he's got a copy of it, because if he stops his subscription to these websites, he wants to make sure he's not locking himself out of the information. Ancestry has got a really good new feature. And I can't remember when they introduced it, but it's in the last few months, my knowledge, where they have a bequeath thing. So you can bequeath your research to somebody. So it would have been nice if his dad had done that to him.
Right.
So it's
good.
That's good. So what Tim should do, I think Tim needs to make sure he's got a backup of everything. So he needs to download a copy of his ancestry tree, and that would include all the images, his dad's ancestry tree. That would just be downloading a GEDCOM. So that's all the kind of the words and framework of the family tree. He needs to download copies of the records and photos that his dad may have attached to his family tree. He needs to do that separately. He needs to look on his dad's computer and see, has he got a folder? What would be really helpful if his dad had a folder called My Family History? I do that. Mine's called My Family History because I'm trying to be helpful to
future-proofing.
Yes. Yeah. I think whether his dad did or didn't do that, he needs to look on his dad's computer and see what his dad already has. With some of the accounts, if Tim's going to want to continue with them, then he could look to take them on. But for the minute, if somebody's passed away, quite often you have quite a lot of stuff you need to do. So I would potentially, I don't even know whether this is allowed, but I would change the email address to my email address so that even if the subscription stops, I know if you have an active paid subscription with Ancestry, if you stop paying, your tree will sit there and all your research will sit there. And then at some point in the future, if you want to reactivate your paid subscription, it just all reactivates. And so, but in the meantime, you can only see a cut down version of your tree. So that could be potentially good for Tim.
Yeah. And like, obviously, I don't know the scenario, but is the potential that there's multiple versions of the trees on all of these different sites?
I could. I mean,
obviously, most of it should match up, but it'd be knowing which one's the one to keep.
Yes, it could be worse than that as well, Nathan. He could have multiple trees on multiple websites. So he might have a tree on Ancestry. He might have also added research up to Family Search. He may have a copy of his family history on a family history program. He may have a copy of his family tree on MyHeritage. So I would be trying to look at all of these different trees, all of the places where he has his family tree, see how many people are in the tree, and the tree with the most people in it is most likely his favourite tree that he's added the most information to, make that the king tree. And also, he may have more than one tree on Ancestry, because you can have as many trees as you like. So he may have created several trees on any, yeah. And he may have several trees on his family history software. So it's trying to think, okay, which is the largest family tree, because that is likely to be the most up-to-date family tree. And that's your king one, and then weaving in any other information. But at the moment, for the first thing, because he doesn't even know if he wants to do it yet, he just wants to keep it safe, I'd say back it up. And backing it up is making a copy of everything and also exporting it as a GEDCOM file. Because if Tim doesn't have the family history software installed on Tim's computer, then he can't open up a Roots Magic file. He can't open up a Family TreeMaker file. If he's exported a GEDCOM, he can upload that to Ancestry. He can upload it to Find My Past. He can upload it anywhere and then read the tree. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting as well. It kind of like creates a responsibility for the person that's doing the tree, doesn't it? Like thinking about myself, if I get into this more and more and it becomes a big research thing, I do need to future-proof it and like let my kids know that it's here, and if they want to carry it on, it's there for them.
Mm. Some people, they do a genealogical will, and they will even include money in their will to cover the costs of somebody taking on the family history, because it can be all sorts of costs, whether subscription costs, even just the sheer cost of making sure you're storing the research. Yeah.
Mm.
And just doing it in a kind of, especially if you've got lovely old heirlooms, you want the things stored in a kind of responsible way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's a different landscape now, isn't it? It's like, I've obviously got my mum's stuff, but it's just in a big metal box. Whereas my stuff, it's all digital. There won't be a paper trail per se. It's all these subscriptions and these websites.
And that's in a way makes our digital era research so vulnerable, doesn't it? Because, with your mum's box, that's there. And in 10 years' time, if you decided, let's say you hadn't got into family history now, you could decide in 10 years' time that you want to pick up where your mum left off. You open up the metal box, and providing there hasn't been too much condensation of things in the box, if your box is kept in a nice dry house, everything in there is going to be fine, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Barring fire, flood, blah, blah, all that. But it should all be fine, and it's really accessible. Whereas, you know, if you've got your family history on an online software on your computer, and that laptop's long gone, the family history is long gone with that laptop. Or if somebody's got it on a online, you know, family tree, and you don't know about it, then again, it's not part of the family heritage.
Yeah, it's lost forever. Yeah, one misplaced email address or password, and it's lost, isn't it? That's a little bit terrifying.
Yes.
And if somebody's put so much time and energy into it, you want to pass that on, don't you? You don't want to be like, oh, I've done this. I'm not bothered about giving it to anyone else. It's, you're creating your family history, aren't you? I hadn't even thought about that.
Even if people think they're not interested, sooner or later, somebody gets interested again. So it needs to be, you know, handable on and handed on.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, I'm a prime example, aren't I? Like, I've got to this age, my main source and contact is my mum. And I'm like, oh, why didn't I get into this earlier? Talk to more, you know, older relatives. And the answer was, I was younger and I wasn't interested. It is an age thing, isn't it? You get to that point where you suddenly want to do it.
Mm. It's funny. You can't really put your finger on it, but that's a conversation which, you know, so many of us say that. It's just the passing of time. And I don't know. I mean, I, as you say, like you were saying about SAS Rogue Heroes, and you never would have wanted to watch, you know, any kind of history-inspired dramas in the past. And then now you're thinking, oh, it's just pretty interesting. And you're more interested in history. And that loads of people hated history at school. And then time goes by and history is presented in a much more engaging way now. And so, you know, many people who were really put off history at school just realise that it's such a world of adventure and escapism and fun to learn about it.
It really is. And like the prospect of potentially having a story for one of your ancestors. Obviously, I'm not going to go to the extremes of them, like someone being in the SAS or something like that. But you never know, do you? And that's the excitement part. It's like, wow, what story can I find? And yeah, it's cool.
So for poor Tim, I feel like I haven't given very good information. It's definitely back everything up for the first stage. And it's you backing up the tree is at GEDCOM, backing up all the records, checking what his dad has on his computer, making sure he's got the biggest, presumably most up-to-date tree as his king tree. I think that's probably everything. There's a really interesting question. I love it. So earlier this week, I was editing the questions to go in the next issue of Family Tree, our monthly magazine. And there was this just a little small reader question with an answer from an expert. And it was, you know, when you find something, it's a little unexpected gold nugget. And this expert had done a brilliant answer. She's called Pauline Jarvis, and she's from Rootle Genealogy. And she'd done a 10-step plan. Somebody had said, how do I pass on to the flip side of Tim, who's been bequeathed all this stuff in a messy kind of way? Or this person, this reader was saying, how do I make my family history passable on? How do I pass it on? Yeah, to my descendants. So this person was prepping. They're doing all what we should do. And then Pauline had given these lovely steps, really practical things. But the final step, she said, pass on the stories, because that's what's going to capture everyone's imagination and make sure they actually care about your family history. And I think that is such a good tip, because that is like with your kids, even, you don't even have to be old. If you've got some stories to pass on, that will weave into their head. Even now, things you're finding out, they'll weave into your kids' heads. And then 30 years' time, your kids will be like, what did Dad say again? And they'll be interested.
Who was that guy who invented the Concorde?
Exactly. Yeah. So do you think we've got to homework time now?
I think it is homework time. I feel like I'd write my own homework this week.
Okay, tell me what your homework is.
I'm going to take a subscription, take the plunge, and try not to get bogged down too much with the hints that Ancestry offer me, but focus on, obviously, the great-grandparents and see where that takes me. And also, if I've got enough time, because I feel like I might get lost within that, but if I've got enough time, I'm going to try and find the path that finds me where Auntie Mildred comes from.
Okay.
I'm not going to ask my mum. I don't want to be as simple as that. I want to see if I can find it on the tree. And like my starting block is, I think it was on my nana's side. So if I follow her path and her brothers and sisters, I'm hoping she'll appear. So, but that does feel like a lot also. Anyway, that's what I'm
going to find out next time then. Good luck, Nathan.
You never know. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, till next time. Goodbye.
Bye.